Well, good morning to all of you. Welcome to you who are tuned in on our webcast. Last week we had 25 on our webcast, and I think we had 30 in church. So today it's quite a full house, and I thank you for all coming today. We have, hello. Turn off your cell phones, please. We have a couple of newlyweds in the room that I can see. Appreciate you being here and being with us. There are some visitors from far-flung places, and we welcome all of you. We also have a couple of people from the across the water a little bit. And Bonita is here with her son, and I hope all of you get to know them. If you don't, this gives an opportunity to also think about. We have some new kids in the room, I think, and we welcome them. It's good that we can be families joined together. But we're missing our fishermen. Mr. Rust is catching the big ones up in New York, reeling them in, and bringing us fresh fish, right? I don't know if they'll make it that far. While we have no announcements, one thing does come to mind. There will not be too many times when we can get together until it'll be the Feast of Trumpets. And on the Feast of Trumpets, we're hosting everybody from across the water to come over here. So we'll be a quite lively and larger group. And we'll have to get very well organized for that event, from taking care of the Holy Day offering, greeting people at the door, making sure whatever services they need. Together now. I know that you don't really want me to speak, but I didn't know it was that ardent that you were going to play special music or music to close the services till we meet again. I thought I was appreciated. And I can't help but just remark, Joy and I, my wife Joy and I, were talking about you this morning, Bonnie, and hoping we would see you. We often think about a lot of you and what your needs are. Every morning we have coffee. Before that, I have some prayer time. And I think about a lot of you and your lives and your journeys, things that I want to tell you to help you, areas where I see that you're blessed, and just thanking God for that. If we've got people that are making good strides in life, and some of us have new roads in front of us, too. And for that, we can all be thankful that at least there's a road. I was just talking with Joy this today again, that how some people don't realize what they've got until they lose life. And I did, and now I have it, and I'm so thankful for that, no matter how debilitated it might have left me from time to time. To begin this sermon, I thought I would give you a little opportunity to make some comment. Can you think of anything in the recent past of our national government that you think has been a wrong decision? What do you think about, Job? What do you think? That's a good comment. Prayer being taken out of schools. Anybody else have any idea? Over here? Same-sex marriage. Who made that decision? Supreme Court. Anybody aware of the trade agreement that was recently passed by our president and Congress? Is that beneficial to our nation? No, it's not. What about the Affordable Care Act? Who's for it? Anybody for it? Unaffordable. Bonnie, you make good with it, huh? So far, well, you're the one, and we're glad it works for you. I bring out these examples because it helps us to lace together something that is perhaps not first seen. These decisions are not made by just the president. They're made certainly by the executive office that he holds. There's also decisions made by the legislative branch of government, like the Affordable Care Act. You need to vote yes for this, and then we can read it later, quote unquote. Then we have our judicial system saying that same-sex marriage is something that we have to understand. And now that is being put down the funnel to our young kids, and they're going to be learning about the ways that people who have same-sex relationships enjoy sexual gratification. All of these things add up to some very difficult times. And it is not just looking at one particular branch of government. It's man's government that is not performing in a good way. In Ezekiel chapter 33, I am given an assignment from on high. When I first came to the islands of Florida, I made this part of what I thought was so important to my duty for the brethren here. Ezekiel 33, and in the first six verses, Ezekiel 33:1, where it talks about the duty to show right from wrong, that God wants this said. The Lord spoke his word to me. He said, "Son of man, speak to your people. Tell them, suppose I bring war on this country, and the people of this country choose one of their men and make him their watchman. 3. If he sees the enemy coming to attack the country, he will blow his horn and warn the people. If the people hear the horn but ignore the warning and the enemy comes and takes them, they will be responsible for their own deaths. They heard the sound of the horn but ignored its warning, so they are responsible for their own deaths. If they had taken the warning, they would have been saving themselves." Then it says, closing in verse 6, "But if the watchman sees the enemy coming and does blow his horn to warn the people and the enemy and comes and kills someone, the watchman who hasn't done his job must die because of his sin. I will hold him responsible for their deaths." In short, I do not want to be responsible for your deaths. Sometimes it's important for me to be very clear that I don't want this judgment passed on me from God. I want to warn you of what's going wrong in life. Sometimes it just falls from one page of the newspaper to the other, from one internet site to another. And the gravity of where we are, as our age is crumbling around us, needs to be underlined from time to time. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, that when we find examples, we should learn from them. 1 Corinthians 10, he says we should learn from history. In verse 6, 1 Corinthians 10, 6 through 15, "These things have become examples for us that we won't desire what is evil so as they did. So don't worship false gods as some of them did. The scripture says the people sat down to a feast and turned it into an orgy. We shouldn't sin sexually, as some of them did, and 23,000 of them died in one day. We shouldn't put the Lord to the test, as some of them did. They were killed by snakes. 10. Don't complain of some of them did. The angel of death destroyed them. These things happen to make them an example for others. These things were written down as a warning for us. We are the living ones in the closing days of history. So people who think they are standing firm should be careful that they don't fall." Moving to 14. "Therefore, my dear friends, get as far away from the worship of false gods as you can." I'm talking to intelligent people. "Judge for yourselves what I am saying." We need to be very firm in our mind about what we're staying away from and what we're drawing close to. Now, in this thought, telling you that I feel I must give you a warning from time to time to really consider what's around us and realize there's many things written in history that we can learn from. Well, we can come up with some little thoughts about, and maybe they are bigger to some than others. Are you staying away from sin, drugs, sex sins, lust, such things as that? Now, there's a particular part of God's Word, and I guess there are many of them that are similar, that have to do with this. And I want to take you through one chapter in the Old Testament, Micah, one of the minor prophets, Micah chapter 6. And that basically is our text for today. It's 13 verses long. I'll move from back and forth sometimes for the sake of it, growing some thoughts. But I want you to realize the clarity that is here about the times in which we live. There are four points that are going to be covered in this chapter that I'll talk to you about. The first one is ingratitude. The second one is ignorance of God's way and having a religious pretense. The third one is dishonesty and injustice, corruption. And the fourth one is idolatry and pagan worship. So as I go through these four points, and I'll mention them again, if you've found yourself interested as a note taker, I want to go through Micah chapter 6 in some detail with you. This is focused on God's difficulty that he has with Israel. And it's about the entire nation of Israel, the house of Judah and the house of Israel, all of the tribes. And this becomes then an example for us to learn because it has its application to a nation. But when you read through, there's an application to the church and there is an application to you personally. So the four points, while they might apply to our nation at large, we need to be very careful about them in a personal manner. So as he starts in Micah 6, he talks about the problems in a general way to begin with. And he uses the language of a court trial. Now, some of you have some legal aptitude and work in legal areas. You know about the importance of court law. And so the God says in verse 1, "Arise, contend you before the mountains, and let the hills hear the voice." So let's get together and have the authorities that could be there listen to what we have to say. "Hear, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and you strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a controversy with his people, and he will plead for Israel." And so in this first couple of verses, he says, I want to use some pleading, which is what happens in a courtroom. I want to plead my case. And so he uses a legalistic approach to us. Let's put the matters out here and let's make some judgment. And the judgment then starts in verse 3 with the first point, ingratitude. It says, "O my people, what have I done to you? Where have I wearied you?" So you bring the evidence that I've really been a difficult God for you, he says. "Testify against me. What evidence do you have that I have not been a good father to you in heaven?" And then it goes on to say in verse 4, "For I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of servants, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam." Now, those of you acquainted with American history know what happened in the late 1700s in our nation and how indeed that we became a nation is a miracle in itself and how there was such a significant change from the way that we are governed or at that point. And certainly that's the case going back into, let's call it ancient history, the history of Israel and Judah. When they came into the promised land, God was with them and walked before them. The nations, the small nations in front of them fell, the Canaanitish nations. But he uses a unique word there in verse 4. He says he's redeemed us. He bought us back. And he bought Israel back from slavery in Egypt and gave them freedom from that. He brought our nation back from slavery to the crown and gave us freedom there. He has looked into your life and brought you back in spite of you being the ones who should have the death penalty for the sins you have done. Each one of us have been redeemed. God considers us his children and he wants to work with us. So when we look at Israel, we know they're redeemed from Egypt. And we know a sacrifice was made for us, and every year at the time of Passover, it is renewed. And so we're renewed and certainly bought back at baptism. And we have then leaders that have been established for us. In our nation today, there's a lot of people upset about our leadership. And rightfully or wrongfully so, that mindset is easy for us to take in our own lives and be upset about the leadership that we find leading us. I don't speak of that personally. I know there's no one that's upset with me, and if you are, we can talk about it. But we need to remember government is meant, and it should be there, as God's government. So when you think back about this, you see ingratitude that these people were enduring. They forgot their calling. They forgot their baptism in crossing the Red Sea and then again in the Jordan River. They forgot what had been given to them. They forgot about the freedoms that they were enjoying. Our forefathers gave up everything, and most of them gave up their lives so that we could have a nation. And what have we now brought before the throne of God? Is this a good sign from your evidence? I don't think you see it that way. And we need to be very careful then that we don't become a people that is ungrateful. That we don't take certain things in our lives, just simple things like baptism and our calling, for granted. It becomes a very pivotal point for everything that we have. You might have nothing else but the forgiveness of your sins. And that is worth a tremendous amount. Worth more than anything else. So he goes on in verses 5 and 6 and brings them to some history that ancient Israel went through, telling them, you aren't remembering where you came from. And that they had ingratitude. He says, remember now, verse 5, what Balak, king of Moab, consulted. Now in Numbers 22, and if you wish to put something in your Micah 6 chapter, that might help you. We'll go back there. But in Numbers 22, now this case of Balaam and so forth comes forward, or Balak gets into Balaam a little later in the chapter. Numbers 22:1. Here's what he's asking them. Have you forgotten this? That the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side of Jordan by Jericho. And Balak the son of Zippor saw the Israelites and what they had done to the Amorites. Now the Moabites were very afraid of the people because there were many. And the nation of Moab was distressed because the children of Israel, Maya added, was so large. And so he says in 4, saying to the elders of Midian, now shall this company lick us up round about, just as the ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balaam, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. And he sent messengers to Balaam. He was the son of Beor, and he lived in Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people. He called him and saying, behold, there's this great people come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now, therefore, I ask you, curse me this people, that they are too many for me. Peradventure, I might prevail that we might smite them, that I might drive them out of the land. For I wot that whom you blessed is blessed, or I know that when you bless someone, it is blessed, and when you curse someone, they are cursed. And so he appeals to something that you found in your own life. You've crossed the river, you found a great life, but there's somebody that doesn't like you living that life. And there's people that come against you. It might be an employer, it might be someone of your household. And they just don't like the fact that you're doing what you're doing. They might not even be able to describe it clearly, but they see through the eyes of Satan, the eyes of God. And God is with you. And so, this is what happens when that continues. Going down to across the page or so, Numbers 24. The first seven verses. So this fellow Balaam that was called to curse, as people, beings, have been called to curse you, and even curse our nation. When he saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he would not at other times to seek for enchantments, but he set his face towards the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel abiding in his tents according to their tribes. And the Spirit of God then came upon him. So there is a great God who will fight your battles. And he took up the parable, and he told Balaam, what you've seen is the man whose eyes are open. And he said, which heard the words of God, which saw the vision of the Almighty, falling into a trance, yet he had his eyes open. And so his remark was, how goodly are the tents of Jacob and the tents of Israel. As the valleys are, they spread forth as gardens by the river's side. As the trees of lined with aloes, which the Lord has planted, and as cedar trees beside the waters. He shall pour the water out of his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. So while you might find the roadblocks of curse once in a while in your life, and we've seen that in our nation, if God is with us, who can be against us? And yet our nation has fallen away from being a godly people. As a Baptist minister I knew at one point told me that our nation is Christian from sea to shining sea. But the problem is it's only a quarter inch thick. And that is what our nation is like today. We claim Christianity, but we don't practice it. And you are among the few who understand what Christianity is. And you must never fall into the hole that our nation has of being ungrateful. You must be grateful for what God has given you in response to his baptism that he's provided, to the blessings that you have enough to eat, enough to clothe yourself with. If we want a tie, we can wear a tie. If we want a necklace, we can put on a necklace. We can have these things, very simple things. And we know that there's times coming that are prophesied in the Bible where people will only use ties to hang someone with. There's going to come a time when the necklace is put around your neck or someone's neck to take their life, because they have become ungrateful and have fallen into the snare of the devil. So across the page, verse 20. And when he looked on Amalek, he took up the parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he will perish forever. And so it is with Satan. He will perish forever. So ingratitude is a problem that we have seen in our nation. We see in ancient Israel, and we must be warned from such scriptures as this, never to become ungrateful ourselves. The second point is ignorance of God and religious pretense. Pretending to be a religious person. Practicing weekend religion. When you're together here, now you're a good person. You're at church. But Monday through, or Sunday maybe through Friday, it's another situation. We cannot be Christians in pretense and be ignorant of what God asks us to do. So it says in Micah, verse 6. Micah 6:6. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high Lord, the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? So if I do these things, these rituals, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Well, should I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? No, I come together every year. I keep the Passover. I find a way to wash feet, take the bread and the wine. I follow the example of Christ. I take the Passover. So everything's good, right? It's only as good as you make it, as good as you become obedient. There's no one there during the week to see how you're doing. There's no one checking off every day how your study and prayer life goes. There's no one knowing whether or not your religion is in pretense and really false and you really don't study the ways of God, except our Father in heaven and Christ his Son. It goes to say that firstborns, I'll give everything. I'll give my children. Look over here in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 3. Verse 27, the very last verse. Then he took his eldest son that he should have reigned in his stead, the king's son, and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. The king was sacrificing his son. And it says, in the manner of a burnt offering. If you read through the beginning chapters of Numbers and see how that was done, how the sacrifice was not only killed, but flayed into its parts and set in order. It's a gruesome thing. And to consider that that was done to your child. Look over in chapter 16 of this book. 2 Kings 16. The first four verses. Here we're talking about Jotham, king of Judah. He was reigning. 20 years old when Ahaz when he began to reign. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem and did not that which is right in the sight of the Lord, his God, like David his father. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire. So not only was it the house of Israel, which maybe you put it in that parlance and say, well, Judah, they were obedient. Well, here's a king of Judah that sacrificed his son in fire, according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Across the page, chapter 17 and verse 17. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire. They used divination and enchantments and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. It's hard to imagine that in the house of God. I've been attending these services since I was, since 1955. That's a way back. I've seen people come into these congregations and leave and go back into the most heinous activities that you can imagine. I won't compliment some of what they've done with the name or the title of religion. Once you find your calling from God, you cannot let your religion be false and a pretense, a show. You must read, you must study, you must practice. And these people had every opportunity. Their kings, though, were sacrificing their children. We that are potential kings in the great kingdom to come, are we sacrificing our children? I've had to put on that thought. I've got children that are grown, and I've got grandchildren now. I have to put on that thought. How well have I done with my family? When you consider your family, how have you done? Are you teaching them good values that are so deep that they'll never leave them? Why have some people left before you? So these kings of Judah and Israel practiced child sacrifice, as horrible as that might seem, and yet we sometimes do that ourselves. Not with the knife and the fire, but with the implements of Satan's warfare today. I think you understand the contrast is that God is interested in your family, not in the choicest animal, and out in the rivers of oil. You can do all kinds of things to try to make up for what is wrong, and that can never happen. So we move on to verse 8. A very clear verse. Once you study it, and you can study it further, I would hope, through the week. Micah 6, verse 8. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? What does God want you to do rather than this false religious view? What does He want you to not be ignorant of? What does He want you to seek and have it deep into your very being? He says, first of all, to do justly. There's three things in this verse. Verse 8, three things. Do justly. Remember what it says in James 1, verse 27. True religion and undefiled before God. What is it to be just, to be pure in our religious practice? Our response to God should be evidenced in our ethical conduct towards all. That we do things justly. We cannot be a condemning person. We can make decisions about what's right and wrong, and we can guide our own lives. But we need to do justly. And when we're doing that, then we won't cheat monetarily. We won't cheat in comment. We won't cheat on someone's character by saying something that is against their character. We won't murder someone's character. We'll be just in the way that we treat each other. Our words will be positive. And even if there's something that shouldn't be said, that is positive, we'll leave things alone from time to time. Some things are not ours to say. Yet in our day and age, every one of us, I know I'm tempted to imply motive so often. There's no way that I can know motive. I can only know mine. And I need to be just before God when I'm doing that and considering that motive. Then it says, and to love mercy. We must love, as it says in one translation, love kindness. To say and do what is good. So often, again, we're quick to condemn in our society, and there is a lot to condemn, but it isn't ours to worry about. Worry about yourself. And so you try to uphold the best reputation. Now, God says in Hosea 6:6 that He delights in loyalty above sacrifice. So we'll be loyal in our mercy and providing mercy. See, we can have an opportunity then to freely and willingly, properly promote others. Promote others. Our nation does not do that. It tears each other down. It finds camps. It makes enemies. It separates. We see this, and it isn't godly. Remember what Christ said about chief seats? You go up there, and it's not the right thing. Solomon talks about it too. Take the lower seat. If you're called up, well and good. But be merciful. Think there could be someone with more than you. And then it says the third thing, to walk humbly with your God. In Deuteronomy 26, let me read to you a couple of verses here. Verse 16, 17, and 18. Deuteronomy 26, 16. This day the Lord your God has commanded you to do these statutes and judgments. You shall therefore keep them and do them with all your heart and with all your soul. Some very new covenant words, really. So it should be in your heart, not just in your hand. You have avouched or you've sworn to the Lord this day that he will be your God and to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments and his judgments, and to listen to his voice. And the Lord has sworn then to you this day to be, you'll be his peculiar people, as he has promised you, and you shall keep all his commandments. He'll make you high above all nations, above all those that he's made, in praise and in name and in honor, and that you may be as a holy people unto the Lord your God as he has spoken. A very unique opportunity. Contrasting that we should understand that this thought of keeping the law and being involved with a merciful walk is something that should be understood from our very beginnings. Sacrifice is something we can do of ourselves, but it won't make up for anything. It won't make up for us at all. Now, these thoughts in that verse 8 are really an overview of what Christ said in Matthew 23:23. He said, you've omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done and not to leave the other undone. So we find judgment, mercy, and faith answering then to walk humbly with God. To follow him requires that faith. So I want you to consider how Micah's thought is repeated by your Christ. He then says in verse 9, the end of point 2, of ignorance of God and following religious pretense. He says in 9, the Lord's voice cries unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see your name and hear you the rod and who has appointed it. He'll see whether or not you're following the direction that you're pointed. We then go to point 3, dishonesty and injustice and corruption. People buy their votes. Today we're finding out who has the most money, so who can approach the presidency with the most opportunity to buy it. Can you imagine that's what's important to people now? Who has the most money to win? Not who has sanity, a strong spiritual heart, an understanding of peace and honor. We are finding ourselves the most miserable situation as a nation. So dishonesty and injustice and corruption is point 3. It says in verse 10, are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the scant measure that is abominable? Shall I count them pure with the wicked balances in the bag of deceitful weights? I brought out an example about this. The last time I gave this sermon, that's very clear in my mind. Joy and I have a friend named Frederico. He's a short fella, always wears a black beret, and he is a fishmonger. He buys fish from fishermen and then sells them to you. Now, he's got more shark and more shrimp and all these things that you would want to eat, and that's what a lot of people come to him to buy. But I go there to buy real fish. And he'll open his ice chest, a very large thing, and show me the fish that he has in there. I said, no, I want fish. Sometimes he's tried to sell me a fish that I don't want. And he even brought to my attention last day, well, do you want any manta ray? I got some good manta ray. No, I don't want that. And so he opens it up, and this time that I was there, there were two halibut about like this, and there were three bass, ocean bass, about like this. And so he says, which one do you want? And I said, well, let me look at them. So he, and that one, and that one. And I looked their eyes over, and the one had real bright eyes. He was extremely fresh. I want that one. Okay. So he takes it out, fillets it for me, because I don't want the head, because I'm married to my wife, and I want to stay married to my wife. He skins it. He'll even take out the pin bones for me if I would ask him. And then he goes to his scale to weigh it. Now, if you look at his scale, scales, there's more than one there. And he has two. Now, I've known him long enough that I want him to only weigh it on the scale that is a little brighter and a little newer. Because the other scale, not quite what I want it to weigh. It's going to weigh more. So he always, I said, now, put it on that scale. And he does. So I got my fillets. We went home and had Bass Veracruz, and it was delicious. Fixed with some special olives, very finely chopped jalapenos, fresh tomatoes, salt, pepper, a little garlic, and an onion. And then I baked it. Now, if you come over, I'll give you some if my wife will let me bring it in the house. Yeah, not the head, okay? Then we can. Anyhow, we had a good time eating that fish. But it all started with knowing that I was getting a fair deal from the scale. And that's what I want you to remember. Have you ever seen someone cheat you at the store? Do you realize that there's people that are employed to go around all the time to check those pumps where you get your gas? Because sometimes they're not right. And so they have to be calibrated. Well, there is a lot of deceit in our land. Verse 12, for the rich men thereof are full of violence, and the inhabitants thereof have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. So just because they have money doesn't mean that they're right. There is a lot of dishonesty. And yet you and I must be very honorable. We cannot be dishonest. We cannot be corrupt. We must adhere very closely to the ethics that are God-centered. He says, if you don't, you're going to have verse 13, I will make you sick when I'm killing you and making you desolate because of your sins. There's going to be emptiness in your belly if that's how you live. There'll be emptiness in your life. 14, you shall eat but not be satisfied, and your casting down or your failure shall be in the midst of you, and you shall take hold but shall not deliver. And that which you deliver will I give up to the sword. You shall sow, but you will not reap. You'll tread the olives, but you'll not anoint yourself with oil or sweet wine. And you're not going to be drinking the good wine. So when we think about dishonesty and injustice, we see it all around us. Perhaps it isn't in the grocery store, because now we've got scanners, and yet even those fail. We have problems in life where there is dishonesty. Moving to point four, there's idolatry and pagan worship. And that's covered in the last verse, 16. Micah 6:16. For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab. And you walk in their counsels, that I should make you desolate and the inhabitants thereof a hissing. Therefore, you shall bear the reproach of my people. Now, there's two things in here, and if you do a little research, it'll be coming close to you, or you'll understand what he says about the statutes of Omri and the works of Ahab. Now, the statutes of Omri, I found this for the sake of a short comment. The founder of Samaria and of Ahab's wicked house, a supporter of Jeroboam's superstitions. This verse is a recapitulation of what has more fully stated below. Judah's sin and consequent punishment. Judah imitated Israel's sin. When you look at what has been going on in life, you'll see that there's a lot of people that follow the way of Ahab. And then it does talk about the works of Ahab. He and Jezebel would lie. They would cheat. They would steal. They would do anything to advance their purpose, their person, and their office. This has happened throughout the history of mankind. It's happened in our nation, and we need to be careful that it doesn't happen in our personal life. I found this in the United Church of God commentary, an online commentary that we have, about Micah 6:16. It refers to the wickedness of Omri and especially his son Ahab, who were the first kings of Israel to bring Baal worship into prominence. Of Omri, the Bible says, Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord and did worse than all those that were before him. He founded the city of Samaria, which was virtually synonymous with idolatry. Israel is shown to be following Omri and Ahab's evil ways. The name Baal means Lord. Many today worship a Lord they believe to be the true God, yet they are sadly deceived. Many people follow that way and think about it. You know, there's a lot of people that want to be popular today, and to be popular, they got to spend money and they got to spend time, and they become popular. After 10, 15, 20 years, people like them. They want to see them. They want to touch them. In fact, they get so popular and the paparazzi are after them that they'll put on sunglasses and an old t-shirt so nobody knows who they are. That's where popularity gets you. I found a book that I've spent quite a bit of time reading and finished it lately. It's called The Vanishing Word. And I want to read just a segment to you. I guess it's three paragraphs starting on page 24. This book explains how we have become a nation filled with idolatry. And while you may not bow down to a rock shaped like a person on Easter Island, you indeed are being brought in to a way of idolatry. You don't even know it. I didn't know some of the things that he mentioned in here. It has a lot to do with how things go on in our mind and come to our mind. So he says in this introduction, page 25, here we are now hitchhiking on the information highway. The computer has ushered us into the information age. In a decade or so, television and the computer will probably merge into one technology. It is highly likely that text will be de-emphasized in whatever form electronic media takes in the future. He said you won't be reading, you'll be watching. And that is important to us to know. When you think back to ancient Israel and some of the things that we read about them, when they said that they were going to keep God's law, they were reading the law. They were not watching it as some kind of a play act that somebody did. Now, there's nothing wrong with watching, but there's everything right about reading. He says, this is altogether frightening, for it was a logos-centered culture that helped to produce our heritage as a nation, as well as American democracy itself? What will be the birth child of the continuing devaluation of the written word? The devaluation of the word and its hostile supplanting by the image is a direct assault on the religion of the book. In accordance to this thought, we are in danger of becoming pagans. Not just pagans, but mindless and defenseless pagans who would prefer to have someone tell us how to think and behave. The possibility of tyranny still exists for us today because we have lost the biblical and mental defenses to arm ourselves against demagoguery. People tell you what to do, and that's what you do, not what the book says. Our children are not being equipped to spot counterfeit leaders who would lead us astray with the overabundance of pathos, emotion. Kenneth Burke told us that the one reason we should study Hitler is to, quote, discover what kind of medicine this madman had concocted, that we may know with greater accuracy against exactly what to guard against. If we are to forestall the concocting of similar medicine in America, paganism never really died in modern Western culture. It was only restrained. American religion effectively suppressed many pagan forms up until the 20th century. But the advent of image-based media has brought forth a revitalization of the pagan gods in popular culture. Sex, violence, and celebrity, which are so pervasive in the media, conform to a pagan ideal. Now just think what the Israelites saw when they came out of Egypt. Think what they found when they went into the Promised Land. Think what our forefathers left when they came across the waters from England and Europe. And we became at that point a Bible-based people. And yet that seems to have flittered away. And now we go to church and we watch. And that's an unfortunate matter. Ignoring history's warnings of technology's tendencies to change us, we have blindly boarded a glitzy train with a one-way ticket to Digit City. Like Pinocchio, we are being hoodwinked into making a journey to Pleasure Island, and we could quite possibly share the same fate as those laughing donkeys, getting into a matter of literature in Tomorrowland. As you see, when we look at things, I often check the internet for news stories and so forth. Well, first they want to show me a picture of it. A commentator is going to come on and tell me what I'm going to look at. For me to read it, you don't need to do that. I'll make the decision for you. And so we find ourselves really looking at the image rather than the word. And it's easy for that philosophy to creep into what we are doing and need to do with the book. See, we need to review our past and examine our history, where we have been. And we need to remember that individually. That is then your key to know your future. If you know where you've been and what you gave up, you can know where you want to go. Our nation has forgotten to consider where it came from. And any amount of leadership now that is godless will not bring us onto centering way of life. So in conclusion, these four points stand out. Ingratitude, that's the first. Second, ignorance of God and religious pretense. Third, dishonesty and injustice and corruption. Fourth, idolatry and pagan worship. Now let's just turn to the next chapter in Micah for a concluding thought. Micah 7, the first four verses. Here the church is complaining about her small number. Not an uncommon complaint. We often complain that there aren't too many people that really want to follow the way of God in the Bible. Woe is me, for I am as when they have gathered the summer fruits, as the grape gleanings of the vintage. There is no cluster to eat. My soul desires the first ripe fruit, though. The good man has perished out of the earth. There is no upright among them. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net, that they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asks, and the judge asks for a reward, and the great man, he utters his mischief desire. So they wrap up their goings and comings. The best of them is a briar. The most upright is sharper than a thorn hedge. The day of the watchman and the visitation comes. Now shall be their perplexity. The day of listening to a warning about your society will come to its end. The watchman will be gone. And we will all have to individually walk on our own two feet in the right direction. So as I started with Ezekiel 33 about a watchman, so we end with this verse here. The end is coming, and be warned by the watchman. And you walk in the ways of God.